a lot more of that going on than we realized.
This is an outcropping of a larger problem, which is that we don't have affordable housing in this country, and certainly in places like the San Francisco mm-hmm. Bay Area, where there are people working for enormous companies and often well-paid people who are in this situation that still can't afford basic housing.
Yeah, I met people who were pushed out of the Bay Area when I believe they were in like a manufactured housing park. And, you know, that was swept away for luxury condos. And suddenly those people were living in a van because there was really nowhere else they could afford.
Yeah.
I met a guy also from the Bay Area who had been a San Francisco cab driver for many years, planned to retire on the value of his medallion, but got pushed out by Uber, found his medallion was no longer worth a dime, and is also living in a van. So it's really quite striking to see the situations that have gotten these people out on the road.
Yeah. Maybe Tom Joad is out there somewhere, and maybe before he loses the ability to keep driving, he and a few other folks in a similar situation can get together and do something about it, because ultimately, I don't know if there's any other alternative. Jessica Bruder, she is the author of Nomadland, Surviving America in the 21st Century. Thank you so much for talking with us about this, and thank you for your time.
Yeah, thanks for caring about these people and their stories.
Happy trails. Happy trails.
That's all the time we have this week on Now It's the News. Now It's the News was created and produced by Derek Blair. For more information, go to nowitsthenews.com, follow us on Twitter at nowitsthenews, and until next week, I remain yours truly, Derek Blair.
Happy trails!
She seems happier. Her fur is so much shinier, silkier, softer. She has really mellowed a lot.
Sheba is a 105 lean pounds of shiny, smooth, happy dog for life.
The shedding has stopped. The itching has stopped.
Since 2001, we've helped more than 250,000 dogs get over their nutritional deficiency miseries.
And saved our customers bazillions in vet bills.
Everything we tried failed except the Dynavite.
Come to Dynavite for help.
Dinovite .com.
If you want the dog to be healthy, you got to feed it something healthy.
The omega-3 fatty acids,
flaxseed, zinc, alfalfa,
the digestive enzymes that are cooked out of regular dog food.
Dynavite is nutrition.
Dynavite for life.
Don't let your dog itch, scratch, stink, or shed like crazy.
Come to Dynavite for help.
859-428-1000.
859-428-1000.
Dinovite.com.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HuntertonChamberRadio.com, brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
The news is sponsored by the Hunterdon Medical Center. Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
USA Radio News.
Law enforcement officials identified the person in custody today in a Texas school shooting as 17-year-old Demetrios Pagortzis. Authorities are also combing through his social media page. Texas Governor Greg Abbott held a press conference a short time ago.
The weapons used in this attack, there are two weapons. One was a shotgun, and the other is a .38 revolver. Neither of these weapons were owned or legally possessed by the shooter. It's my information that both of these weapons were obtained by the shooter from his father.
Authorities also found explosive devices, including Molotov cocktails, in the school and nearby. After his arrest, the suspect also said he intended on killing himself, but he lacked the courage to do so. This is USA Radio News.
If you or anyone you love has been diagnosed with lung cancer, asbestosis, or mesothelioma, your diagnosis may be the result of job-related exposure to asbestos, and you may be entitled to compensation. Over $30 billion in trusts have been set aside for individuals who have been affected by asbestos exposure. How do you protect your rights and get the compensation you deserve? Call Capital Legal Group now at 800-400-LUNG. Capital Legal Group is one of the nation's resources for settlement of lung cancer and mesothelioma cases. Law firms have successfully recovered over $2.7 billion for their clients in all 50 states, and claims have been paid in as little as 60 days. If you or a family member were diagnosed with lung cancer, asbestosis, or mesothelioma, call Capital Legal Group now at 800-400-LUNG. We'll open a no-cost case review on your behalf. A history of tobacco use or cigarette smoking will not disqualify your case. Visit 800-400-LUNG.com or call 800-400-LUNG. Call 800-400-5864 now. That's 800-400-LUNG.
A Florida man.
We're right in Ringo's, just sandwiched between Flemington and Lambertville, and so we're quite local to Hunterdon.
Oh, and quite local to me. I live over by something called the Clover Hill Church in one of the developments, so I probably drive past the road to your farm very often when I head down to Trenton or Camden or someplace else. But Maria, good afternoon. I understand that you've been working with horses for many, many years. Is that right?
That's right.
And I understand also that you are on the faculty at Rutgers. And tell our audience, what is it that you do at Rutgers?
So I'm very honored to be part of the faculty at Rutgers Medical School. Before, I was with the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey, which that later merged into Rutgers, and I was a faculty member there for over 12 years, and primarily doing research and for a brief period of time working with the University Medical Group as a clinician, doing some clinical work. But mostly these days, I am a lecturer for the university, so I come in and teach mostly the medical residents. These are psychiatry residents, along with some of the medical students, the third-year medical students. But I also co-founded an elective that's taught twice a year in the medical school. Just about 10 years ago, I pioneered a course and introduced it to the university to help medical students improve their bedside manners. And we did that using horses. And initially, we paired up with Rutgers Equine Center, which is right on Route 1, so that we can have horses. But eventually, we teamed up with Spring Rains of Hope, another organization, where we actually have students come out to a farm right here in Three Bridges. Before that, it was in Hillsboro. And we teach the fall and spring elective, and generally, we have about 12 students that come.
That sounds fascinating. Why is it that working with horses helps doctors to have a better bedside manner with their patients?
That's a great question. And that's exactly the question that the board made sure to that it was clear for them, because as you can imagine, you know, the East Coast in general, I think we were one of the few universities on the East Coast that offers it. We were the first on the East Coast at the time.
You know, that surprises me. This is Pat Smits, and what surprises me is that people haven't recognized that sooner. And I'm sure that anyone who's grown up around horses, as I did, can certainly see how that could be very helpful, especially with some of the doctors who need better bedside manner.
Well,
that's right.
I always am impressed when people who work with animals try to translate that into working with people, because the one thing I've always known that animals seem to respond to, even wild animals, is kindness. And trying to figure out what an animal is about, what its needs are, what it wants, what it's trying to do, is certainly one way of coexisting with them. But how does that translate from horses to people?
Well, that's part of the problem in medical education is that while medical students, you know, get an enormous amount, you know, these folks that even make it through medical school, to even be admitted into medical school, they're very intelligent. The education provides a really thorough understanding of the diagnostics and categories. These folks have to memorize enormous amounts of information. The problem is that the verbal component, organizing material from what patients tell them, is something that gets hammered in during medical school. The problem is there's no education really structured around nonverbal communication. So while they're very adept early on about summarizing, providing summaries, reports, and diagnostic reports, and so forth, being able to connect to patients in the other language, the nonverbal communication, is something that's kind of eluded medical school education. There's really no formalized way of introducing it. Mm-hmm. And so part of the importance of introducing a course that's what we call experiential, meaning that while there's a lecture component to it, the learning about how to become more empathic with your patients and in this course is more of an experiential piece, meaning that you learn by doing and you also learn from watching your peers. So the horse is a natural teacher for teaching bedside manners, actually. Pat, if you've been, you said you have experience with horses, then you'll, as I'm talking about this, will be able to identify with it. In the medical community, there's something, especially among students, called false confidence. You know, there's a discrepancy between what a young person knows intellectually and yet the gap between that and their clinical years of experience. So when they then have to encounter a situation with a real-life patient who turns to them and says, well, you're a young one, how can I trust that you know what you're doing? You don't have the experience. And so there's something about being a young trainee, being in critical situations and having to make those kinds of decisions where that idea of false confidence comes up. Well, the same kind of tentativeness arises when you're having to confront the 1,000-pound animal, and in that moment you have a choice. You could either fake it till you make it or be able to recognize that you don't have all the information. And what people like to hear, patients or anybody, is honesty, is a level of integrity and honesty, and being able to approach a clinical situation with, you know, Ms. Smith, I'm trying the best that I could do to understand your situation. Right now we don't have answers, but I have a team of people. We're working in a multidisciplinary environment to try to get you help. It's better than a student feeling the pressure of having to know everything in that moment.
Well, that's a fascinating, it sounds like a very fascinating discussion and a very fascinating topic.
Well, let me ask you something, though. It would seem to me that for students, at least residents in psychiatry and courses in psychiatry for medical students, that there would be a lot of information about nonverbal communication because, of course, you know, it's not what the patient, especially mental health area, not what the patient says, but, you know, you have to read those signals.
Surprisingly not, Pat.
Really?
In the psychiatry. But the elective is actually open to all medical students. So we actually have students in the surgery, family medicine, neurology, podiatry, I mean, all disciplines.
Well, I think that's important. And in fact, in my experience, one of the reasons that so many of the family physicians are so effective is that they have a wonderful bedside manner. I won't say the same about surgeons in my experience, but, you know, this is they're like the, now I grew up in the Midwest where you had a small town doctors, and, you know, they talked to you in plain language, and they were part of the community, and I don't think they would have survived in the small towns if they didn't have a good bedside manner.
And research shows that physicians who have better or experience with having better bedside manners actually get less lawsuits.
Well, you know, That's so, I'm cutting you off, but that's so, that's really interesting that you said that, because I had this conversation just recently with a doctor, a specialist that I see, and had this exact conversation that in the small town I grew up in, certainly doctors made mistakes just like everyone else. I can't imagine anyone suing a doctor. You know, I suppose it would, you know, horrible, horrible maybe, but, you know, this was recognized that, you know, these doctors were doing the best that they can, and medicine is not perfect. And now sometimes people seem to think that everything has to be perfect and there are never any problems. But that's interesting that you say that, because I just had this conversation.
I was curious about something, and when I read your website, I know that in effect what you've done is you've kind of married clinical psychology with equestrian sports, including in things like dressage and trail riding and things like that. But how do you get a horse to like you and trust you, both as a rider and as an owner? The horses to me seem to be unique animals.
Yeah, you know, some people think it might just be giving them treats. I think any time you approach a creature with, what can I do for you? How can I make you comfortable? In that moment that you're perceived as a friend. And in the horse world, anything that you do that preserves both their physical and mental balance, and there is a real reason why their physical balance is critical to them. Obviously, if they fall and they're unbalanced, they can become food for a larger another animal, a cougar, a tiger. So anytime in your riding or anything that you ask of them physically that helps preserve their balance and then mentally puts them in a space where they're mentally balanced, you're perceived as a friend. So sometimes people have this impression that because we ask them to work or do something like jump a fence or go on a long trail ride, that can rupture a relationship. I think that a horse, you have to come to them believing that they enjoy your company. You have to come believing that you both can enjoy each other and that you both can be friends. And energetically speaking, when you take that position, and especially ask the question, what can I do for you? How can I make you happy? What can I do to make you comfortable? That's oftentimes all you need. And I think horses, like humans, I mean, they're culturally speaking, a lot of traditions, the way we treat our guests, for example, making sure that they're well fed and they have to eat. Anytime anyone wants to feel like what a horse feels like, just try being a guest to someone and see which host seemed to make you feel the most comfortable. Where would you have liked to stay and why?
It's very interesting comments. I'm curious about something. How do you motivate a horse beyond food, which is the obvious motivation for most animals, and also kindness? How do you get them to like you and want to please you? We know dogs like to please you. We know cats, and I've had many cats because my wife loves cats, and we sometimes joke and call her the patron saint of cats. I can get cats to do just about anything, but I have to bribe them. So the question is, what is it unique with horses that you do to get them to want to please you and figure out what it is you want them to do?
Each horse, as every individual, is quite an individual. Some horses in the beginning are motivated primarily by food, but that can evolve and that can change. For example, right now I have a Mustang horse in my barn that's coming for training, and the Mustangs are wild animals. They're not domesticated animals. They live in the range, and pretty much the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, herds them and rounds them up and then puts them up for adoption. But for the most part, they're wild creatures and for generations have roamed the plains. So how do you motivate an animal that's been wild to willingly enjoy what you're doing with them? Their heart really is in the prairie, so to speak. They want to run. They want to be out. And in the beginning, it could just mean, hey, I have some interesting food you might like. But as that relationship evolves, you might start to see a horse shift and be just as pleased to spend time with you because they associate you with petting them, grooming them. They associate you with giving them praise. For some horses, I can see they really light up and get really comforted when I tell them good boy, good girl. So even with the void of treats, their willingness to please you is very obvious. No different than a dog or a cat, but everyone is individual, and oftentimes you might have to start with something like a food motivator or a grooming motivator, or many times it's even shortening the work itself.
Well, that's really very interesting for me because from where my horses came, but what's fascinating is that, yes, you would take a Mustang who had no contact with humans. I mean, one of the things that with horses is when they're young, if you raise horses, you're used to having contact, and they're used to having contact with humans, just as most dogs. And you know the difference between wild cats. I mean, you don't want to take a wild cat.
Cat aren't all cats wild.
But this to me is fascinating because I can imagine it, you know, not that it's totally comparable, but it would be like a child who had very little contact with a human being when they're little, and they have a very different, outlook in life. I mean, they're really not used to being close to people. They haven't, children who've been in, for example, a number of foster homes. But I think that's fascinating that you're able to take Mustangs. I know that one of our horses came from the West and was wild, and it took years before that horse, you could even ride him. In fact, you could never ride him bareback.
Mm-hmm. Marie, this is John. A question for you.
Bill
asked a very good question.
On the side of the road and adopting it.
I'm sorry.
John? We couldn't quite hear you.
Oh, sorry about that. Were you saying something?
Yeah, we couldn't quite hear what you said, Maria. You were reacting to Pat's story about the Mustang that she knew as a child.
Yes, so it's similar to, in a way, finding a baby cub, like a fox, on the side of the road and raising it. At the end of the day, we would really cringe at the idea that somebody brought a fox into their home and treated it like a dog. And so with the Mustangs, actually, surprisingly, they're quite easier than what people would think because they're so pure. But their self-preservation is heightened in contrast to a domesticated horse, so that they make more decisions for themselves earlier in the relationship because they've had to. And their ability, their alertness is magnified. And so there's some interesting differences in that, but you see the purity of the horse in its form with the Mustang.
An interesting thing, I've noticed that with dogs, particularly when you've raised them from puppies, they've been pack animals. They're pack animals rather than herd animals. They have a hierarchy, and dogs seem to really understand body language of human beings, but dogs have been watching people for probably 10,000 years now. What about horses? Can horses read human body language?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Their whole existence relies on being able to read body language. And more than that, it's our biorhythms that they can detect. And that's why, for example, they are a natural teacher to teaching bedside manners. Because we may, with our mouth or our body, say one thing, but our biorhythms, our heart rate and sweat patterns, our breath rate, might say a different story. So you can't really lie with horses.
Maria, there are a breed of horses that are known as therapy horses, and the qualities that you're talking about in the Mustangs sound like the kinds of qualities they breed on these therapy horses. Do you know if the Mustangs are used at all in that area of therapy?
If they're used as, I'm sorry, I didn't get the last part. If they're used as...
I'm sorry, say that again.
I guess John is asking whether or not they're used as, wherever they're used as therapy horses. He wondered if the Mustangs would make good therapy horses.
Oh, yes, sure. The Mustangs have been used in a therapeutic program. I don't know so much about therapeutic riding programs, but certainly they could be if they were under saddle there. But I know that in equine-assisted psychotherapy programs, they've used Mustangs. In fact, a lot of the prison, the correctional facilities nowadays out west, particular, have programs where prisoners can bond and work with a Mustang, helping them get adjusted to domesticated life, and in that way, creating an opportunity for emotional therapy that way.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
Yet you mentioned before that they tend to be a wild breed. How do you account for that? How does their personality change or translate into that empathy that you say that they sort of sense out of human beings and the reactions they have? Is it precisely because they are primordial in the sense that they're very tuned into basic instinctive gestures and perhaps excited motions by people? Does that account for their sensitivity to those human reactions?
Well, I mean, you're looking at hundreds of years of DNA having to survive in different terrain, having to negotiate a hierarchy within their own herd, the survival of the fittest. Darwinian theory dictates the strongest will and the fittest will survive. And so these animals, physically speaking, tend to be very hardy. They can endure the temperatures. They're not as sensitive in that way than our domesticated sport horse might be. For example, their hooves learned to adjust, are malleable and have learned to adjust over hundreds of years to a different terrain. So oftentimes with, for example, sport horses that are more domesticated than bred for a purpose, oftentimes, man has meddled into that formula. Whereas with the Mustang, there's a natural selection that happens. So most of our breeds that are available now are what they man-made. Starting with your racehorse, the thoroughbred. It was the name itself, thoroughly bred. It was a breed that was thoroughly bred by men for the purpose of being quite fast. And it traditionally were used early on by the British nobility for their fox hunting, so being able to go faster over long flat terrain, of course, then racing, using it as a sport horse. And, if you think of some of the other breeds that we might be familiar with, like a quarter horse, they were bred to race a quarter of a mile, and their conformation shows their ability to do that. We have, different breeds. American saddlebreds, for example, were bred carry plantation owners in the south to assess their plantations, which were hundreds of acres, to do so in a comfortable way but yet elegantly. So the Mustang, on the other hand, along with some other breeds, the Marwari being one of them, I'm affiliated with that breed, were not bred for, let's say, a purpose. Nature created that as a result of their ability to survive their terrain and the different hardships in their environment.
Well, let me ask you, and I don't mean to cut you off, but I have never thought that the Mustang was a breed in light of the fact that, they're a combination. I suppose many of them, and that's what many of the American Indians where the, you know, used the horses, and some of the Mustangs are smaller just because they needed to survive in some very difficult areas. But do you consider the Mustang a breed, or just that the fact that they're wild horses?
I can't say that I'm an authority, to be honest, on the Mustang. I'm as a trainer, I'm familiar with, I cannot say it's a breed, it's considered a wild horse, but within the Mustang, there are, for example, pockets of where they do consider a breed, like the Kiger Mustang, K-I-G-E-R, is a distinct Mustang breed that the genetically could be traced back to certain rare Spanish horse, Andalusians, from the Iberian Peninsula. So unlike the kind of traditional Mustang that, yes, has been a compilation of genetics coming from your Andalusian stocks, the traditional, original conquistador horses that arrived and then were kind of had somehow broken free and roamed and bred that way. But in the migration of the Mustang, of course, you had ranch horses escape and other horses interbreeding with them. But there are certain pockets of Mustangs where the genetic profile is very distinct. And so people would say that those would be considered a breed, like the Kiger Mustangs.
Well, you own an interesting breed. You, on your website, I saw you have a Manwari horse that I think comes from India, where they were bred. Is that right?
That's right.
Why don't you tell us about
those? Those are the rarest horses in the world.
Is there one type of horse that you find works better with your medical students? Let's get back to, you know, the fact that you're training medical students. And I mean, I think that's fascinating that you're training medical students using horses. I mean, I could I really do. I mean, I think that, you know, of course, I believe having horses and growing up around horses, that horses can teach all of us a lot. And I felt I was very lucky growing up around horses.
Well, Pat, hence the phrase horse sense, correct? Which most of us in the legal profession lack these days, but...
Churchill
actually said something like, the outside of a horse is good for the inside of a man.
I've never heard that.
Churchill, I think I said that as a quite a famous quote. But I think you're right, Pat. Horses are good. There's a lot of learnings. I don't think there's anything one particular breed that's necessarily better than another. I think there's certain qualities a horse in working, for example, on the ground with, for example, veterans or bereaved children. They should be a horse that, for the most part, can be reliable in that it's not going to be aggressive. So when we select horses, we want to make sure that they're not aggressive. We also like to see an animal that enjoys this kind of work and on some level has sensitivity and that is reactive to people's body language. Oftentimes, for example, when we have horses that have been meddled with quite a bit, if you can imagine a horse that is in a laboratory that's being injected every day, that's being robbed of their natural herd environment, H-E-R-D, their herd, then those signals get blunted and the horse may not be as reactive to the biomarkers that we have because every day they're exposed to that and kind of imposed on to be in that way. So at the end of it, you would want a horse that, for the most part, is living in a herd and with other horses, and then can get plucked out and in a free-range style interact with human beings, and also a horse that has the ability to be safe and not aggressive.
Maria, go ahead, Bill.
Okay, Maria, thank you. That's been very interesting. I know that with other types of animals that I've been around, we usually have to find some kind of game that fits how they function in nature in order to get them to play or interact with us. I found with the cats that we've had, They love to play stalking games because that's what they do. They love to jump. I routinely was able to train a number of our cats to literally jump from one piece of furniture to another and get all around the downstairs.
Well, Bill, I thought cats specialized in just making life uncomfortable for the people they live with.
Oh, no, I always got a lot of enjoyment out of our cats. But, you know, in order to train them, you have to find things that they like to do. And it's amazing what cats will do for bluefish and whipped cream.
Well, Bill,
it sounds like you know the answer to that from experience.
You don't find horses that like whipped cream, in my experience. On the other hand...
Well, Pat, this is a family show. We won't go there, but Maria can comment on that if she would.
On the other hand, I remember probably how often my mother would be so irritated because my jean pockets would be ripped out because I would carry sugar or maybe... an apple in my pocket, and the horses certainly knew that.
Well, that's interesting. Maria, the horses have certain types of behavior or activities that give them pleasure if humans provoke that activity.
You mean like a dog burying a bone?
Yeah, some dogs like to play tug of war, particularly terriers. And
corgis, we know corgis like to play tug of war because I'm experiencing that with Tenacious. I have Tenacious this week, so.
Well, I can tell you, and Maria, maybe you could follow that, but I had a horse that loved to herd cows. Now, much to the chagrin of my family, I mean, we would go in and they didn't like it because, of course, they wanted the cows, to gain weight. These were Herefords, not milk cows. But I had a horse that had absolute delight if I could get him in a field and he would have all the cows herded. And it was amazing, you know, how well he could do that.
This was a horse?
Horse.
Herding
cows.
Cows.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, there are breeds of dogs. Yeah. Like Australian
dogs.
The sheepdog, the corgi, they're famous for that.
But ranch horses.
Ranch horses are herders?
Are herders. Wow. I mean, they're trained to herd cows.
Well, Maria, how trainable are horses? Does it depend on the breed? Are certain breeds more amenable to training than others?
Well, sure thing. Like the example right there, Pat, you gave a lot of horses. For example, certain quarter horse strains, bloodlines, are bred for what they call sorting, which is you have cattle and a horse is taught to sort through the cows. I mean, and they're built for that. They've kind of got a lower neck set, and they can kind of snake their neck down and tell. You have horses in, for example, in South America and Mexico that are used as ranch horses, and they have what they call cow sense. And breeders would look for a horse, a mare, and a stallion that generally are performing in that they have a good cow sense, and they've been kind of bred for that. You have other horses that are, in Europe, in Spain and Portugal, they used to do the, the bullfighting, and they would do it with horses.
Oh, yes.
For those horses, they'd be looking for horses that were pretty brave. I mean, I don't know if I could go into an arena with a bull with a piece of red cloth, let alone my most horses, when they see danger, they want to run the other way. And yet, we've bred animals that they run for the bull. I mean,
look at the Lippinzer stallions. I've had the pleasure of seeing them perform in arenas here in the United States, not once but twice. And these are horses that were trained to fight in battles.
Well, let's get back, though, I'm fascinated with what exactly do you do when you take a group of medical students out to the farm? Can you explain a little bit more about that process and what your goal is? I think we know that the goal is for a better bedside manner, but what kinds of things do they do when they're out there with you?
We have a series of activities. The day starts, for example, around 10, probably ends around 4, and
And we have a series of activities over the course of 2 days that we put them through the paces of basically engaging with things like timing and feel, the pressures that may be involved with working with different people around the patient, meaning the horse. How to engage a patient when you don't have words? How do you get them to follow you and to engage in treatment plan without words? How do you deal with, say, another quote family member, meaning another horse, that's being a bit of a barrier to getting your patient to comply with a certain treatment? How do you deal with introducing yourself? How do you get this 1,000-pound animal without a rope or anything to move in your direction or even stand still so that you can give him an injection?
Right. Or lift his foot.
Yes.
Do you ever try that with the, you know, with a horse, if you try to lift their back foot? I mean, that they really have to have a trust. At least I thought they had to have a trust in order to allow you to do that. Is that something you might try?
Right. So we have them do things like pick up a foot, do a dent, open their mouth and look at the, examine their mouth. Some of the horses in our group are animals that tend to move a lot, so being able to get your patient even to stand still and groom them. How do you get them to stay in one place? How do you get them to move in your direction? What does it take to lift their leg? And the students engage with the kind of sweet spot idea of being clear but kind, for compassionate clarity, and being able to connect to that is, I think, very important to medical students, because that's when burnout happens. It's also an opportunity for them to see that an exercise we have that's always so interesting to me is we have them line up, and initially when they come into the arena, it's the scenario is very similar to how they walk into a waiting room and see someone in chaos, and they'd have to ascertain what's going on and organize information that quickly. So here they are in a new setting with something that's very ominous looking, an animal that they are familiar with, but not entirely. And the idea is to, one by one, they have to connect to the animal. So the instructions are introduce yourself to your patient in whatever way you wish. And when you've made a connection, you can come back to the line. Well, introduce yourself for some people may mean petting them. For some people may just be a verbal hello. Our idea of connecting, too, is very different. So we discuss those things. How did you know your patient connected to you? What did you need to see in order to feel that confirmation? And would you have been able to help them even if you didn't receive that? And then we have different exercises that get people to realize how to work within rules and regulations and still get the care. So a patient had to work in a multidisciplinary team. How to cope with time pressures. And the most important thing that comes out of the course is that level of self-awareness. So a lot of these students, before they go out as doctors, should have a sense of their own coping style, their own style of connecting. Sometimes they've never really thought about it.
Maria, when would the medical students be introduced to the course? Would these be third or fourth year medical students?
Yes, we have. It was open to the third and fourth years, and to our psychiatry residents, like the residency program, which these are residents are formerly doctors, so that they're just specializing. That they left medical school and now they've come here to specialize in psychiatry. And you see such a range of difference as the second, and then of course we opened it up to second years and even pre-doctoral, pre-medical students have joined our group. Because it is open to them as well. And interestingly, we oftentimes, you know, the teachers, the lecturers of the group, which is two of us essentially that run the course, are always fascinated by how interesting it can be that as the level of clinical experience raises, the student's ability to engage and connect empathically and get the job done, so to speak, may vary. younger students are a little unconfident, they're unsure, and so without us having to say anything, they get to actually experience their older peers working through something, and they learn from each other. Quite fascinating. Mm-hmm. And every time I've taught this course, it's always different. The things we're looking to get them to engage with, which is empathy, compassion, timing and feel, being able to use other resources outside of language, how we organize information. One of the things we teach them is how to keep information pure without our emotional, without our own projections. So the fact that a horse is moving close to you, for some people might be seen as that horse likes me. Whereas in reality, we try to teach them to phrase things in more objective terms. So perhaps as the horse is moving in their direction, it would just be that horse is moving in this direction versus it likes me. So really students not only engage with the idea of some of the nonverbal component, but they really learn in the course of 2 days to be a lot more conscious of how they summarize a patient and how much of it is their own projections, because of course these very things, these our own opinions and projections, can actually affect the way we see patients and may not be able to give them the care and attention that they need.
Well, you know, that's interesting, because it seems to me that not only be medical students, but certainly psychologists, social workers, and even lawyers. I mean, I can see that, you know, something like that where, you know, we also have to assess our clients, and we're also in a situation where, you know, I don't think we're taught what we're seeing, the nonverbal skills. We hear what somebody says, but, you know, at least the kind of law that I do, a lot of times people are saying one thing, but that's really not what they're saying if you listen carefully to or look at their body language.
Absolutely, and there's something called, you know, in psychology it's called discrepancies, and that's happening in the human world all the time. And in the medical community, that can take the form of someone who doesn't feel confident in their physician agreeing to taking certain medications or complying, but yet not doing it, and so they fall through the cracks. And so one of the things we try to kind of connect students to is that oftentimes your patients may be saying or doing one thing, but being able to see that there's some level of a discrepancy. See, in the horse world, there is no real discrepancy. If a horse doesn't want to eat, they won't. If they don't like the other horse, they will move away from it. Whereas in our human world, we're tolerating and putting up with quite a bit. And it starts with something as primitive as our food habits. As a child, if you were asked to eat and you no longer wanted to eat, you were full, somebody would guilt you into eating the rest of your food. Then they'd say, there's hungry people in Africa.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, here you are denying your basic feelings of satiation that come. And so we oftentimes do things we say we want to do, and so we connect students to that and make them really understand that that can also get in the way of providing care. And it certainly is something that could be used across different... We have a program with Spring Rains of Hope here. I co-founded that organization many years ago, but we have corporate trainings. We offer it for aviation pilots and even for burnout amongst nurses and physicians. The applications of this to build rapport with clients, patients, is pretty, the lessons are pretty universal. We just happen to see the great value of it, obviously, because of my connection to the medical school. I saw that connection fairly early on, and I think it's just an amazing, it's amazing that these animals, while we don't need them for transport, we definitely haven't lost their value in terms of being able to be helpers in so many other ways.
That's a fascinating topic, and I want to pursue that. We have many, many people here in Hunterdon County who are into equestrian sports. For the average equestrian hobbyist, a horse owner, or somebody who wants to begin to explore that hobby, what sort of things can you offer them and what advice can you give them?
Oh, we're so fortunate in Hunterdon County. I think we are the premier equestrian county in New Jersey, and how lucky we are that the state animal is the horse in New Jersey. There's so many public programs, and then for anybody interested in horses, whether they want to learn to ride or not, they can access either therapeutic riding programs that are in our county. There's equine assisted, meaning ground-based programs that you can learn and become a volunteer or get certified in it, actually. And, of course, in terms of riding, we have so many disciplines here in Hunterdon County. We have a dressage. I'm formerly a classical dressage trainer. We have jumping traditions here. We are also the home of the U.S. equestrian team in Bedminster. And I encourage anyone that's interested in any of these things to reach out to me directly, and I certainly can point you in the direction of... There's always a place for anyone who's a friend of the horse. There's all sorts of nonprofit organizations that people get involved with, and so it doesn't always necessitate sitting on them.
Interesting comment there. What about the work that you do at your farm up on Amwell Ridge? What sort of work do you, what sort of services do you provide, and what kinds of things, what kind of person or equestrian hobbyist is going to want to come to your farm and learn?
So we have, it's a full training barn, meaning that most people that come to me are coming because they want to work in a different way with horses. I'm known around the world for being able to connect horses. Traditionally, been difficult situations, and not only rehabilitate them, but really connect their owners back. So I do a lot of teaching clinics around the country and around the world in the past, more so than now, since I've had my days, trying to teach people a better way. So traditionally, people bring their horses here so that the horse can get physically well and comfortable and, like an athlete, learn how to get the right muscling for what they're going to be doing together. And for the human, learning how to ride more clean, more correct, more of a classical position, which then would allow the horse to be able to express himself under saddle more brilliantly. So if you think of a dancer, you're teaching a horse how to dance, you're helping him use himself, and likewise the human. And so we offer training and lessons. I also, the farm is the home base for a nonprofit organization I started about a year and a half ago.
Was that the Pegasus Foundation?
Yes. So we have the Pegasus Foundation, and that also attracts people from all over that want to volunteer and learn more. And part of the objective for that, separate from our farm agenda, is being able to take one horse at a time and transform them, videotape the transformation, and be then able to educate people about what's involved in taking an animal from A to Z, and then, of course, Z meaning ready for adoption.
So the Pegasus Foundation, as I read your website, is there for horses that are what we call problem horses. Maybe they don't fit into a certain category, maybe they're difficult, maybe they've acquired some bad habits, or they're unusually aggressive. Is that what the purpose of the foundation is, to train them and place them somewhere?
Right, and it's also to educate people, because what happens is, I think, in especially during economic crises, horses are rather expensive. And one of the things that happens, even for horses that are not having problems, is that they can easily, or even horses that have some physical problems that can be rehabilitated, people don't know what's involved to do that. And so my sadness came around seeing, around the economic crisis, how many animals went to slaughter, how many animals got dropped, and all also the struggle of some of these rescue organizations, because they adopt the horse out, but oftentimes, you know, even well-intentioned people may not know what's involved. It's not just a matter of adopting it. The horse needs to be brought along, so to speak. And what does that entail? Well, in order for you not to get hurt, the horse has to be comfortable, and the horse has to be maintained in a certain way. And part of it is just educating people so that that horse doesn't fall back into that cycle that ended them into the slaughterhouse or an auction, so that animal has a chance.
Can I ask you what's happening now with the U.S. government rounding up the Mustangs? Are they still slaughtering so many of them that are not adopted?
Yeah, it's a very unfortunate situation, I think. The position, there's so many sides on how to see it. I mean, the perspective of the ranchers out, there's the perspective of the ranchers who see the Mustang as a vermin. You know, wild bands of horses consume quite a lot of forage. They conflict with their cattle. And so many of these large landowners really would like to see them disappear.
I know that.
Maria, could I ask you a question on the heels of what you're talking about here in terms of the treatment of horses generally? You know, we just came past, you know, one of the heights of the year with the Kentucky Derby and so forth. Could you comment briefly on the racing industry itself and how the animals are treated generally? And, you know, I mean, it's glorified to a great extent. We see on national TV the Churchill Downs and leading the horses from the paddocks and all the pageantry. But what really goes on in the racing industry? Does your area of practice kind of support what they do, or is there room for improvement?
There's always room for improvement. And I have to say that I'm not against racing. I am against how we prepare horses in that industry. And I mean, I raced horses in Europe when I was younger, and I think the tragedy comes in the fact that we take a two-year-old horse. If you can imagine taking, say, a 10-year-old child whose bones are not really formed yet, you know, with the horse, the knees, for example, is one area that then, if they're not closed, that kind of physical activity can actually compel the horse to break down later. So you have animals that are pretty crippled by the time they're 5-6 years old. They're young. I mean, usually we start horses under saddle when they're around four. I like to start them around 4 or 5, depending on the breed, generally when their knees are sealed. So in the racing industry, they're starting them as babies when they're not necessarily mentally ready. So they're teaching them the flight response, which is run. So the more you pull on the reins, the faster they're going to go. So you're capitalizing on that part of them. And you're doing it in a way where, physically speaking, they're younger, so the idea is that they have more energy and they're going to go faster, but you're pounding those sensitive bones. So I'm not against racing. I'm against training methods. And I'm against the fact that for every year that they're not racing, there's an owner that's having to spend money on them, and that's really what it boils down to. There's money involved, and it's not necessarily, the focus is not on the horse's welfare per se. And I think that we can do it differently. I know in Europe they race them like maybe a year later. I think we could do it a lot differently, and I think it could be a much more appealing sport. I mean, the horse, those breeds love to run. You see, they enjoy it. I think that they were bred for it, but I think I see a lot. For every horse that you see in the Derby, there's about 1,000 horses that are going to slaughter, and I think that's unacceptable and unnecessary for sport. And I think there's a very much more responsible way of doing this.